Today's panel is recent developments in election law. I can't promise, based on what I know about this panel, that it'll be any less bleak than the last one, but I'm hoping that we can inject some happiness into it during the lunch hour. My job here today is to introduce Judge Bumate, who's been a great friend to our chapter since he was confirmed as a U.S. Circuit Judge for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit in December of 2019. He's based in San Diego, California. Prior to his appointment, Judge Bumate served as Assistant United States Attorney in the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of California, where he was a member of the Appellate and Narcotics Sections. He also served as a counselor to the Attorney General on criminal law issues, including on national opioid strategy and combating transnational organized crime. Judge Bumate has also worked with the Office of the Deputy Attorney General, the Office of the Associate Attorney General, and the Office of Legal Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice. Judge Bumate has twice received the Attorney General's Distinguished Service Award. Judge Bumate previously worked as an associate at Morvillo, Abramowitz, Grand, Eisen, and Borer in New York, New York. Judge Bumate clerked for the Honorable Timothy M. Timkovich of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th Circuit and the Honorable Sandra L. Towns of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of New York. Judge Bumate earned his B.A. cum laude from Yale University and his J.D. from Harvard Law School. Judge Bumate.
Thanks so much, Dominique. I was going to start off by welcoming you all to my home state of California, but given how the morning has went, I'm going to skip that. But I have to say, you know, I've been coming to this Western Conference as an attorney for several years, and it's a real honor and a treat to be up here on stage moderating a panel for the first time. So in our panel is a very important one, recent developments in election law. Ensuring fair elections is the lifeblood of our democracy. And over the last few years, we've seen some structural changes in how elections are conducted. And we've seen a number of recent blockbuster Supreme Court cases on election law. To help explain these developments, we have an outstanding panel of election law experts. Our first speaker is Daniel Sir of the Liberty Justice Center. He specializes in campaign finance and election law. Next, we'll have Scott Kendall of Cashin, Gilmore, and Ladmuth. He's an expert in Alaskan election law. We'll then have Professor Richard Pildes of the New York University School of Law. Professor Pildes is one of the nation's leading scholars on constitutional law and a frequent commentator on election law issues. Then we'll have Professor Bradley Smith of Capital University Law School. Professor Smith was a former chairman of the Federal Election Commission. Next, we will have former Attorney General Terry Goddard, now of Goddard Law. General Goddard was a supporter of Arizona Proposition 211, which targeted so-called dark money in campaigns. Finally, we'll end with Corey Langhofer, managing attorney at Stagecraft PLLC. He concentrates on campaign finance and served as litigation counsel for the presidential campaigns of Mitt Romney and Donald Trump. Before we get to a Q&A, each of our speakers will give an opening statement. So Dan, if you want to kick us off.
Well, good morning, everybody. Judge, thank you for the introduction. Thank you for getting it right. I have to tell you, I was on a radio show the other day, and I was introduced as Daniel Sir from the Liberal Justice Center. I just want to clarify, that's not right. I'm from the Liberty Justice Center. We love liberty. We love justice. We're not very much in the center. That said, actually, my job this morning is not to be particularly ideological. Rather, it's sort of to lay a baseline for the conversation we'll have and talk about election law changes in the last few years. So knowing that, I assume you all think we're going to talk about Dominion voting systems, there'll be a discussion of forensic audits, we'll talk about Maricopa County a lot. That actually won't be the panel we have this morning. The panel that we'll have this morning is going to be focused on campaign finance, on structural changes to elections and how they're administered, and we'll talk a little bit about redistricting. So let me start with campaign finance. I'm sure many of you think, didn't this all get solved with Citizens United? And in fact, it's sort of interesting that we've gone now over a decade and the Supreme Court hasn't had a particularly big campaign finance decision since Citizens United. Last term we had the Ted Cruz versus FEC case, which was kind of an interesting little side note on the FEC, but we haven't really had one of those big foundational cases. Unless you think that Americans for Prosperity is one of those big foundational cases. Those of you who are from California may know the Americans for Prosperity case. It was against your attorney general. And it's about donor privacy, but it comes in the nonprofit C3 context. What are the rules for nonprofit organizations when they have to disclose to the Internal Revenue Service, or in this case, to the Attorney General of California? And I'll just tell you a quick fun nugget of that case. So Liberty Justice Center, we had an amicus brief in it, and so I was following the case. And the day the decision came down, the national director of the ACLU tweets out, "This is a terrible decision for our democracy, that dark money is going to flood our elections because of this decision upholding or striking down California's rule." The next day, the ACLU national director tweets out, "Sorry, I've learned that we had an amicus brief in support of Americans for Prosperity because there are important privacy interests somewhere in the emanations and penumbras of the Constitution, presumably, important privacy interests for nonprofit groups." So Americans for Prosperity is this case saying the California Attorney General can't compel nonprofit organizations to turn over their donor lists, and setting up this sort of more robust, exacting scrutiny to determine when that's appropriate. And the ACLU's brief is actually filed on behalf of a number of liberal organizations saying, "We don't want to turn over our lists as C3s, but campaign finance is different. Campaign finance is, there are separate interests there that are compelling that you should maintain the previous rule." So we will just have to see whether or not Americans for Prosperity as a precedent actually becomes a major campaign finance case, or if it is held strictly in the nonprofit space. So the second thing we'll talk about, especially I know Scott's going to talk about, are changes to the structure of our elections. We're all used to the sort of basic ballots that we've had for a long time, but ranked choice voting is taking hold in more and more states. Alaska is one of them, but we've seen it in New York City's elections for mayor in the last few years, and also changes in how we do primaries. And I think one of the things that's interesting for us as lawyers is we sort of assume the way we've done elections has some sort of constitutional dimension to it. And actually, as originalists, Justice Scalia would remind us that the Australian ballot, the sort of secret ballot that we are all used to, was not how it was done at the founding. In the founding era, you would have white, male landowners show up and vote in person out loud, usually with a lot of beer from the candidates at the ballot box. And so there's not necessarily a constitutional dimension to how these things are done. And so it's really state constitutions that are dictating whether or not changes like ranked choice voting or top 2, 3, 4 primaries, or sometimes people call jungle primaries, like you have here in California. So the Supreme Court a few years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court had a case called Washington State Grange that sort of said, this is not our job. There are basic principles here that we need to respect around freedom of speech and association. But as long as states do that, if you want to go different than how we've always done it, that is your prerogative as a state. And we're seeing more and more states take advantage of that flexibility. And from a policy perspective, I will probably disagree with Scott in a little bit when we get later on. And then the third thing that we'll talk about this morning is redistricting. And so on the one hand, it's like, hey, great, we've made it another decade, right? Like, this is pretty much in the rearview mirror. And in many ways, I think this round of redistricting, based on the last census, as much as there was potential for disaster because of the timeline for how the census unfolded, really from a litigation perspective, there has not been a major case. And I think that reflects the fact that Rusho versus Common Cause from the Supreme Court several years ago sort of said, we're not going to do the partisan analysis as a reason to strike down a map. If a map is drawn for partisan reasons, there's just not a justiciable test that we as a court can look at and administer in a way that says this is too gerrymandered. And so pretty much across the country, I think this term, we've seen this round of redistricting, we've seen pretty few federal lawsuits. There'll always be the Voting Rights Act lawsuits, but not beyond that. The shift then has been to state courts, right? Much as in the abortion context, when you have a case like Dobbs, say we're going to return this to the states and state legislatures, what it actually means is we're going to return this to state Supreme Courts to determine whether or not their state constitutions provide an independent basis for ruling. And so Professor will have a comment in a few moments about the independent state legislatures theory and how redistricting may change as now we see state Supreme Courts taking a leading role. So those are the three things that you have to look forward to this morning. And with that, I'll turn it to Scott to kick us off.
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. And thank you for the introduction, Your Honor. So I'm, you know, as you can tell from the way I'm dressed, I'm the weirdo from Alaska. So in Alaska, you may have heard, or you may not have, we've passed sort of a revolutionary new election system. I was the author, and I helped run the campaign, and I've defended it in court. But we had kind of a fundamental problem. The problem starts with 63% of Alaskans don't affiliate with either major party. First of all, you know, that's sort of our baseline, and yet we were dominated by the two parties like everywhere else is. The other problem we saw, which is a nationwide problem, is through closed primaries, 8% of the electorate elects 80% of Congress. Whatever you think of that, we, at least as Alaskans, thought that was a broken model. We proposed what we would call free market elections. Open competition, may the best ideas win. That took the form of Ballot Measure 2, which was passed in 2020, and had three primary parts, some of which Daniel touched on. First off, we have an open primary now. Instead of two closed ballots, we have one ballot. Every single candidate, regardless of party or lack thereof, is on one ballot. Every voter gets the same ballot, and you choose your favorite. Some people call it jungle primary. We like to call it the tundra primary. that goes into, and the ranked choice voting element, which is only in place for the general election, gets all the attention, but really, Alaskans, and myself in particular, have found the open primary part is really the key that unlocks the reform, which what it means is every viable candidate is transmitted on to the general election, and you don't have issues where perhaps one non-viable candidate, a candidate has a late scandal and all of a sudden the election results get distorted. Or you don't have the situation where you have three candidates running, one of whom plays a spoiler impact, and someone gets elected with a plurality. So really, the ranked choice voting is only there in place to sort out the four candidates that go on to the ballot. And then the final piece of our reform was a ban on what they call dark money. And we've had, you know, what I believe is an elegant solution, which is this only impacts, of course, super PACs, independent spending. It doesn't impact federal races because we can't, but we have, through the regulatory process, actually allowed a structure that prevents the Americans for Prosperity problem, which is nonprofits do all kinds of things. Sometimes they also dabble in elections. People can have a privacy right in donating to nonprofits that do non-electoral activity. And at least in Alaska, our solution has been these entities, whether they be Planned Parenthood, the NRA, or Americans for Apple Pie, have a political activities account. And they ask their donors to check off. If you put it in this bucket, it may be disclosed. If you put it in the bucket for other activities, it won't be. And so far, that has worked rather well. We'll see. There's, of course, going to be litigation. With respect to the implementation, which is what most people ask me about, what was gratifying was we've done a lot of post-election polling and exit polling. It wasn't confusing to voters. And we did this first run of this system under, you know, what you'd call hard mode, because our long time, the congressman for all Alaska, Don Young, who had held the seat for 49 years, passed away in March of last year. We immediately had to do a special election, which became our only, Alaska's first and only by-mail election because of the timeline for the primary. And then we actually had to combine the ranked choice special election with a normal primary at once in August. And we did that, and nonetheless, despite what would be kind of procedural headwinds, 99.8% of the ballots counted. That's an outstanding rate, even under a conventional system. So voters weren't confused, the ballots weren't spoiled. and then we did some polling again, kind of post-general election. How did Alaskans feel about it? 95% said they received adequate instruction on how to vote. 85% said ranked choice voting was simple. 62% said they liked and supported the system. We've had various legal challenges. I won't get into details because some of it's still pending. But I will say to Daniel's comment about how elections really are, large part, they're a creation of each state. So our reform has been attacked twice, both pre-enactment and post-enactment under our state constitution. Both times we've survived at the Superior Court and Supreme Court. And then sort of the bright shiny object for everyone is Sarah Palin. How could Sarah Palin possibly run in Alaska and lose? She is, you know, I guess to people outside, the most famous Alaskan. She also has phenomenally high negative ratings. But just sort of looking at implementation writ large, we had 62 races. Only a dozen of those actually needed to go to tabulation. So most of them just ended up like a regular election. Someone got 50% plus one and it was over. But of that dozen, only three of those races did someone other than the person in first place win. And what happened was what you would expect to happen. The reform worked. So we had one very Democratic district where two Democrats split the vote. Their votes accumulated and they overtook the Republican. A Democrat won. We had a very strongly Republican district where a Democrat was leading. The two Republicans combined their votes and they came ahead. And the final district was a true swing district. And so we had a Democrat who was way ahead, and then the votes were tabulated, and actually the Republicans squeaked out a win by 7 votes. So a swing district looked like a swing district, a D district and an R district looked like what they should look like. So we really did feel like the reform worked and it didn't favor anyone. One sort of anecdote that I think is useful is how this can provide a safety valve, because when you put more electable people on the ballot as a party, you got a better chance to win. In our governor's race, we actually had 4 candidates move on. We had 2 Republicans, the incumbent conservative but somewhat moderate Republican, a very conservative Republican, and then we had an independent and a Democrat. And although the incumbent kind of led throughout, in a closed Republican primary, he was under real danger from this very conservative Republican. Right after the primary, that very conservative, even though he made the top 4, he had a breaking sexual harassment scandal, absolutely cratered. And you could look at a world where if he had won a Republican primary, he would have handed the race to either the independent or the Democrat. But that, you know, imagine Georgia again, but there's 4 candidates. And in addition to Herschel Walker, you've got another more mainstream, maybe more composed Republican. In the course of the election, the Republicans probably hold that seat. So you can see the situations where it prevents these sort of aberrant outcomes that are either due to a spoiler or candidate quality or late-breaking scandals. And then sort of finally, I'll just touch kind of specifically again on the Sarah Palin, the US House race. People see like, well, holy cow, a Democrat won the seat for the first time in 49 years. Well, that wasn't a Republican seat, that was Don Young's seat, I'll be perfectly honest. You know, he held the seat since before I was born. I've met the guy, and no one was going to beat him but Father Time. And obviously, that eventually happened. But he held that seat throughout a Democratic senator being in Alaska, a 2-term Democratic governor, another Democratic senator. So it's not as though Alaska is monolithic Republican. We do trend to the right because of resources and unlocking our lands. But we're a bit more complicated than that. Don Young was unique in that he was one of the most bipartisan representatives. He had strong labor support, and he had the support of the Alaska Native community. And what people don't know about Mary Peltola, his Democratic successor, is first of all, she's a rural Alaska Democrat, which would be probably a conservative Republican in California, quite honestly. She's pro-oil development. She's petitioned Joe Biden, President Biden, for the Willow Prospect, which is an enormous oil and gas development on the North Slope. So the politics there are just a bit different. But she also had the great good fortune of running against 2 people who, in Sarah Palin and Nick Begich, who had enormously high negatives. So it wasn't so much an aberrant outcome as, you know, she sort of got gifted with opponents she could beat. And because we have total transparency in our elections, we have what's called the cast vote record. So we can go through and we can kind of see all the rankings on a spreadsheet. And what that showed was she was beating either one of them by 10 points, whether head-to-head, ranked choice, it didn't matter. So the outcome in that race was more about candidate quality, but we did really get an interesting outcome because the same electorate statewide elected a very conservative governor, a moderate Republican in Lisa Murkowski, and Mary Peltola, who's a moderate Democrat. But if you look at kind of the moderation of where that kind of fulcrum is, it actually makes sense considering our opponents. So with that, I'll pass it on.
So first of all, I want to apologize for having accepted the invitation to speak here. I think when the Federalist Society invited us, they didn't actually expect that all of us would accept. And so now you have this panel where we each have about 7 minutes to talk about very complex issues. So my issue is the question presented in the most important election case before the Supreme Court this year, a case called Moore versus Harper, which is on what's called the independent state legislature doctrine. Michael Luttig, the former federal court of appeals judge, has described this as the single most important case on American democracy and for American democracy in the nation's history. Now, I consider that a bit hyperbolic. Actually, I don't know if you can be a bit hyperbolic. Is it like being a bit pregnant? So it's hyperbolic. But there's still a tremendous amount at stake in this case. And I know some of you are going to be familiar with the issues. Many of you may not be. So just to briefly describe the issue and then to explain the stakes, the U.S. Constitution gives state legislatures, that's the term, the power to regulate our national elections for House, for Senate, for the presidency. For the House and Senate, Congress can step in and take over that function, but Congress has done very little regulation of national elections. The most prominent example is the Voting Rights Act. So most of the national election process is regulated at the state level. The provisions in the Constitution don't give the power to regulate these elections to the states. The term is the legislatures. And so for justices on the court who perceive themselves to be textualists, it sort of raises the question, how does the legislature relate to other parts of state government under these U.S. constitutional provisions? Now, what that would mean concretely is complicated because there are a lot of different versions of a doctrine that would recognize the independence of state legislatures from other parts of state government. So the most extreme version of a potential doctrine in this area is the view that state constitutions cannot constrain state legislatures when they are regulating national elections. If the court were to embrace that view, and I think there's no indication from the argument that just took place in December that the court is going to adopt this view, but if the court were to embrace the view that state constitutions can't constrain state legislatures in this area, it would be greatly destabilizing of a lot of the existing structure of our elections. Because there's a great deal of election law or issues about the structure of elections that is embedded in state constitutions. To just, you know, pick up on the example Scott was talking about, when voters in Alaska voted in 2020, to adopt this top four primary structure with ranked choice voting in the general election. State constitutions regulate things like whether there's early voting, how much early voting, whether there's absentee voting, under what conditions, the dispute resolution process for elections. So it would be extremely destabilizing if it turns out that state constitutions can't play this role. As I say, from the argument in December, I think there's not much appetite for that view among the court. There may be a few votes for it, but I don't see a majority there. A more likely scenario is a narrower version of this doctrine, which is that state constitutions can regulate elections, including for federal offices, through their terms. And if they do that in a fairly specific way, state courts can enforce those provisions. So there are a number of states that ban partisan gerrymandering explicitly. New York, where I'm from, is one of those states. Our state court struck down the Democratic gerrymander of New York in this round. And those kinds of provisions would still be enforceable. But what a number of justices seem troubled about is state courts using more general, broad constitutional provisions to then invalidate state election laws regulating federal elections. And in particular, the case that's before the US Supreme Court from North Carolina involves the state court enforcing a free elections provision along with provisions like the First Amendment and concluding that partisan gerrymandering violates these provisions. So if the court were to embrace this narrower view of the independence of state legislatures when they regulate national elections, this view would be something like the position that specific provisions in state constitutions can be enforced, but more general provisions cannot be. And I think the idea behind that distinction would be it's an intrusion on the legislative function for state courts to rely on broad provisions in state constitutions to strike down state election laws. Now, if the court really does go down this path, even though it's the more narrow path, it would raise a whole host of questions and tremendous uncertainty about the election structure, because now we would have to start asking questions, how specific does a state constitutional provision have to be okay and enforceable? And when do they become too broad and too general so that when state courts enforce them, they are violating the US Constitution and the power of state legislatures? For example, many state constitutions have right to vote provisions, unlike the US Constitution. Are those provisions specific enough to be enforceable against state election laws, or are they too broad and too general? Does it matter if state courts have developed a body of precedent around a particular provision? So it may start out, as many constitutional provisions do, you know, as a fairly broad, equal protection-like provision, but you know, over time, it's been given more determinate content. Does it then become okay for state courts to enforce that provision? Does that mean the same provision in a state that doesn't have this body of precedent can't be enforced by state courts, but in the state nearby, it can be because they've already developed some precedent around these issues? So even though this is the more narrow path, and if the court accepts some version of this doctrine, I believe it will be a version like this, it would still raise a tremendous amount of legal uncertainty in the election context. And what will happen is whichever side loses in the state courts when a state constitutional provision gets invoked, they will, of course, then federalize the issue and go to federal court and try to assert that the state court has now violated the US Constitution. And in the election context, the one thing we need more than anything is a set of clear rules that are set in advance of the election so that the process isn't constantly roiled by one side or the other side running to state or federal court or maybe both. And you know, you can see the kind of questions that will inevitably get into that maw of election litigation if the court endorses even the narrow version of this independent state legislature doctrine. So that's an initial perspective on what's at stake and how to understand that issue.
Thank you. Professor Smith?
Okay. Well, thank you all for coming, and thank you to the Federalist Society for inviting me. I am disturbed. There's some kind of atmospheric disturbance going on out here. The sky is like this blue color, and there's this gold ball up in the air. We don't have either of those in Ohio, where I come from. I haven't seen either of those, at least in a long time. In any case, I was asked to say a few words about disclosure today. Disclosure has been the big issue in campaign finance, really since the Citizens United opinion. Immediately after the Citizens United opinion, there was a number of columns and suggestions, articles, and so on by people generally on the political left, but some on the right as well, who favor broad disclosure statutes and campaign finance limitations, essentially arguing that disclosure could now be the new weapon to limit corporate and other participation in elections through two ways. One is through a sort of a name and shame game that has become more and more prevalent and that most of you are probably at least vaguely familiar with. And the other is simply through the burden of excessive regulation. And that because the court in Citizens United seemed to bless disclosure, we could use that as a way to actually limit the participation in campaigns. Now, the court's history on disclosure is long and mixed. If you go way back in the 1950s, of course, there was an earlier effort to use disclosure laws to silence certain political points of view. And we saw these in a number of cases. They range from cases like Shelton v. Tucker, you remember or may remember, where teachers were asked to declare their affiliation with various outfits, Communist Party, things like that. And perhaps most famously in a case called NAACP versus Alabama, although that's one of only many cases some of you may remember from law school, you know, cases like Talley v. California and others. And in NAACP versus Alabama, the state of Alabama essentially sought in the 1950s to destroy the state NAACP by obtaining a list of the donors and members of the organization and publicizing it, or at least knowing it would be publicized in such a way that it would discourage people from participating in those donations. And the Supreme Court has long protected, coming out of those cases, a right to contribute and to speak anonymously on issues of public concern and on political issues. At the same time, in Buckley v. Valeo in 1976, the Supreme Court upheld disclosure of campaign contributions. And so these two decisions, or these two lines, are really in a certain amount of tension here. Judge Easterbrook of the Seventh Circuit, in a case called Majors v. Abel on disclosure, actually issued an opinion using the term dubitante. It is the only time I've ever seen that in a judicial opinion. It's basically a phrase that means, I don't know what the hell's going on here, kind of saying, I'm not going to dissent, but I just can't figure out what we're supposed to be doing in precedent. And Easterbrook was, you know, generally considered a pretty good judge. A few years later, Judge Janice Rogers Brown, again, for a very good panel, including her, Randolph, and Santel, in an opinion called Van Hollen versus Federal Election Commission, noted the strange arc of disclosure in the Supreme Court, and finally concluded that, quote, both the individual's right to speak anonymously and the public's interest in public disclosure are firmly entrenched in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence. So, you know, the question is, what is one to do? In practice, the compromise that had sort of been reached was that we would allow disclosure where people were expressly advocating the election or defeat of a candidate or contributing to a candidate's campaign, but otherwise, we would not have that disclosure on broad issues of public concern and so on. Should we support that? Well, that's been, you know, pretty well accepted. I wonder if we should support so readily disclosure of even direct campaign contributions. I sometimes will ask audiences, particularly I like to do this with liberal groups because they get all worked up. I say things like, well, what do you think, you know, if the government were to pass a law that would require the government to maintain a database of people's political activity, and people would have to report their political activity to the government. And this would be available, made available, by the way, to potential employers and you know, and people like that. When Bush was president, Bush too, I would specifically say, I'd often kind of say, you know, the Bush administration has introduced this bill, and oh, the steam would be coming out of their ears. They'd be, you know, and I said, well, they're just trying to stop, you know, foreign influence in American elections and so on, and they'd be all terribly upset by this, and then I'd point out that, well, we already have that law, and it's called the Federal Election Campaign Act, and most states have it, and it requires reporting of your campaign contributions, your political affiliations, memberships, interests to the state where it's put into a database where they keep track of it, and your employers or creditors or other people can get at it. Do you think that's a good idea? I don't know, but we've kind of accepted that. So that's where we are at the present time. Now, in any case, since Citizens United, the object of the, basically, again, I think we can say the political left has been to expand the realm of disclosure. There's not been an effort by conservatives or others to trim back disclosure of campaign contributions as it was understood under Buckley. The effort has been entirely the other way, to expand this universe to include all kinds of discussion of things that might influence elections but aren't really directly going to a candidate. We see that in recent efforts in Alaska. We see it in recent efforts in Arizona, to my right. The Arizona Proposition 211, for example, is going to require disclosure of people if they've contributed to such things as what's called, if a group spends up to $25,000, which isn't very much, you know, in what's called PASO, if they promote, attack, support, or oppose a candidate within 6 months before the election. So essentially, you've got a six-month blackout period where you can't say anything that would promote or support a candidate. It's a question of whether you can endorse legislation the candidate has proposed, or even if you just want to talk about the legislation, maybe Congress or in the state level, the state legislature is actively debating it. That's a real problem. It includes adds mention a candidate within 90 days before a primary through the general election. So as you can see, that could be in some states in a 6-8, even a 9-month blackout period in many states. It applies to get out the vote efforts and so on. And so this is what we're really looking at, is an effort to massively expand the state's basically, I mean, surveillance doesn't sound like quite the right word because it sounds more sinister, but that's basically what it is, the state surveillance of what people are contributing to, what groups you belong to, and so on. The Supreme Court in Buckley had rejected that precisely because, and it knew that those ads could affect elections, but it said, you know, everything affects elections at some level. We're sitting up here talking, and this might influence how you decide to vote, whether you vote for a particular candidate or not, and you can't really do that. In any case, we do have the AFPF versus Bonta decision from out here in California not long ago. Should be noted that my group, the Institute for Free Speech, had a similar case, the Supreme Court took the Bonta case, and then after it decided, Bonta sent our case back here with instructions to follow Bonta. So I do have a dog in that fight. But I would note that Bonta required that the informational interest of the voters be real. You got to have a real informational interest, not just, you can't just say it. And what is that informational interest? The court made clear, and this takes us back to Buckley, I think, and is correct on Buckley, that the only real informational interest is trying to help voters understand how a candidate might act in office. It wasn't enough that you were just curious. It wasn't enough that you might want to know who was supporting somebody because that might, you might evaluate the credibility of arguments. It was the idea that if you knew that the Chamber of Commerce was supporting somebody, you don't need to know who gives money to the Chamber of Commerce. He's supported by the frickin' Chamber of Commerce. We know what they stand for. This is not like something, you know, bizarre, and we're like, oh, Chamber of Commerce, are they a pro-labor group? You know, that's just not the issue that we have with that sort of thing. And it goes into others as well. It's important as we go forward that Bonta not become a C3 case. Nothing in Bonta is limited to C3s. Nothing in the opinion talks only about C3s. And it is important that we not let that happen because that's what the left will try to do, just as they've done with Citizens United, which is now, you know, they still hate Citizens United privately, but most of the time, you know, Citizens United is really a disclosure case. That's what it's really about. And the Supreme Court endorsed disclosure. And you're like, what? You know, but that's how they try to pan it off. And they'll try to do the same thing with Bonta. This is just a C3 case. The second thing is that those of us on the right have to quit contributing to this, right? There are certain groups on the right that love more than any leftist to talk about dark money threatening our elections, okay? Well, that just fans the flame, and if we have time in Q&A, I can talk a bit more about what dark money actually is and is not and how it does and doesn't influence our elections. But we on the right need to keep the goal in mind, which is we support freedom and we recognize that free and open elections tend to benefit conservative ideas. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Professor Smith. Thank you all. Thanks to the Federalist Society for bringing a few of us who are not necessarily in the same ideological tent to be part of this discussion. I feel privileged, and thank you for the very warm reception that I've been able to get, and certainly the admiration that I'd like to show, having been at the tavern debate and learning that Federalist Society members are both eloquent and loud. But having heard the discussion this morning, I want to make it very clear that I do not believe that bumblebees are fish. And that there are surprisingly common denominators, as Karen Taylor-Robson pointed out in some of her statements between people of various political beliefs. I, for example, am the head of a major water provider in Arizona, and we are co-applicants on the Waters of the United States issues, along with the peoples that were speaking in the earlier panel today. So there's a lot of commonality here, and I think one of them should be disclosure of political contributions. And let me just tell a story. I'll try to do it briefly. Back in 2014, there was an election for the Corporation Commission in Arizona. You may probably are aware that Arizona has five statewide elected corporation commissioners who regulate electric rates. Now, a major utility, Arizona Public Service, decided apparently that they were annoyed at some of the positions that the then majority of the Corporation Commission had taken, and they were going to do something about it. And they promoted or found two candidates, relatively unknown candidates, to run first in the Republican primary, and then if they were successful, obviously, in the general election. And they were successful in the Republican primary, due in large part to an awful lot of independent campaign spending. They then went on and proceeded to win the general election, these two candidates. And then a year later, 2 years later actually, they voted for a very large increase in utility rates, benefiting Arizona Public Service, and costing the consumers approximately $100 million a year. Now, it was 5 years after that election that, because of some new members of that Corporation Commission, we found out that the private company had spent over $10 million as an independent campaign to elect those two commissioners. And the outrage was palpable in our state, and I want to make it very clear that Arizona Public Service has renounced that type of activity. They will not do it anymore. They've had a change in management, and I commend them for that. But the anger was real, and we talked a lot about, okay, how does that dark money get eliminated? How do you make sure you know what the source of the funds is? And I can't say for sure that the Arizona electorate would have decided a different way. Nobody can predict that. But I think if the voters had known before the election that a major interest group was putting substantial resources behind particular candidates, it would have influenced the result of the election, if they'd known that before the election. And I'd like to add one more point, and that is the type of advertising that was used both in the primary and in the general, both against Republicans and against Democrats, was, in my humble opinion, despicable. They basically distorted a record. In the Republican primary, a young man named Vernon Parker, who was a very up-and-coming Republican, he'd been in the Bush administration in the Department of Commerce. He was the mayor of Paradise Valley, certainly a very conservative part of the state of Arizona. And Vernon was literally destroyed by attack ads that were brought out against him, implying that he was a crooked businessman. It destroyed his business, it killed his political career, and he says to this day it very nearly ruined his marriage. In the general election, there was a commissioner, Sandra Kennedy, who ads were placed against her which said very, very demeaning statements about which appeared to be criminal activity, and it said it was taken from court documents. Well, the court documents were a filing that was made, a complaint made against her husband to collect a debt. Well, sometimes those complaints can be fairly over the top, and this was an example. It was never went to trial. It was not a criminal indictment, and it didn't involve her. But this was used in a way that it made it look like she was criminal. Her teenage daughters, apparently having seen the ad, said, "Mom, never put us through this again." So the type of ads that were run are part and parcel of this story. And I believe very strongly that a corporation, as Arizona Public Service is, with a very good public reputation, one that has been esteemed in our state for years, would never put their name on these ads. But because they work through an intermediary, a C4 named the Free Enterprise Club, a name that tells you nothing about what they're actually for, they could disclaim any knowledge of how these ads were put together and what they said. So two things I think the Arizona electorate heard loud and clear was that dark money tends to diminish and destroy the civility of our elections, sometimes with untruths, often with disparaging statements. And we need to know as voters who it is that is behind a point of view, because it's going to influence our particular vote, our particular view about those items. And the voters took us 6 years to get on the ballot. And I won't go into why it took 6 years. The gentleman on my right is part of that and did a great job, let me say, as an advocate for his side. But after 6 years to get on the ballot, 72% of Arizona voters said, yes, we want to see this kind of a change. We want to know who it is that's supporting a particular point of view. 72% in a time when our state, like many, but I think perhaps completely, is divided politically. We're 50-50, and our attorney general won, for example, by the overwhelming majority of 280 votes. Couldn't be a more divided electorate. But Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives came together saying, we want to know the source of the money that is being spent on elections for election ads. Now, we took Professor, he may not have known this, but we read his materials, Professor Smith's materials carefully, and we tried to make sure that we dealt with this in a very surgical and precise way. Our statute that's now in the books in Arizona only applies to disclosure of money which is used to pay for campaign political ads. That's it. Anything else that a particular nonprofit, in this case we're talking about C4s, of course, is spending for its charitable purposes is not disclosable. And we put a fairly high limit. We don't start disclosure until it's $5,000 or more. And finally, if that's not enough, we added a opt-out provision so that if somebody has to be notified, if they're a major contributor to a nonprofit, they have to be told within some time before a disclosure is going to be made, that they have the option of diverting their money to other purposes of the nonprofit and not to political ads. And in that case, their names will not be disclosed. So we think we've taken care of the privacy issue. We think we've been surgically precise in terms of how this statute is focused. And thank you very much for the chance to talk about it here today. Thanks.
So I guess in light of our past disagreements on ballot access, I'll start with, I want to talk, I think, about the practical effects of donor disclosure and maybe start with some common ground. I really applaud the way General Goddard's new measure in Arizona excludes disclosure of what I think can now be regarded as small dollar donations. His starts at $5,000. And this is in contrast to the federal requirements, where if you give, you know, $200, you'll be itemized, and your future employers and, you know, Match.com dates can all figure out who you supported or opposed, and that seems unnecessarily intrusive. There's no real risk that your $200 contribution might give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption, but it does out you to everyone who wants to be sort of a voyeur on your political life. That seems wrong. And I think he's drawn a wise line by sort of raising that disclosure threshold. We do, though, have a lot of disagreements on the rest of the philosophical points. I generally don't think it's important for me to repeat what Professor Smith said. Generally, I'm in that camp. But I guess I want to say, as a practical matter, I think this dispute between Professor Smith and General Goddard matters a lot less now than it did before. This issue is probably 8 years past its peak. And I say that based on what I see in my own practice. So in 2012 and 14, right after Citizens United, everyone was figuring out, okay, how do we spend corporate dollars in politics? And is it possible to maintain donor privacy as you do that? This issue occupied probably a third, occupied the minds of probably a third of the clients we had in our practice. It was a very large percentage in 2014, 12 and 14. I would say now that's probably less than 10% of our clients. And why is that? Why has the issue, the relevance for in practice dropped so much? I think there's four reasons in my mind. You know, you can't take a poll on like why people don't call with questions, but I can give you my own sense of it. First, in 2012 and 2014, the right occupied the space almost exclusively. Like the, you know, dark money was the Koch network. That was the allegation. And there wasn't someone on the left who was as effective in advocating for their political and policy views. And so it was kind of like the bad guy for the left to beat up on. Now that, you know, Team Soros, let's say, has flooded into the space, it's no longer in the left's political interest to make this a big fight. Second, in 2012 and 2014, we had a false paradigm. We misunderstood the choice. We thought that the options were mandatory and automatic disclosure of your donations. And the alternative, you know, what everyone was trying to get into, was donor privacy. I think we've learned that that is not the correct choice. You still have, yes, mandatory and automatic disclosure, but then the box you're trying to get into is the possibility of donor privacy. And the reason for that is even in a jurisdiction where you can spend money and there's not mandatory automatic disclosure, there's still very often public transparency. So this comes out in lawsuits. Very oftentimes, especially if you're running negative ads, positive ads generally don't draw much blowback. If you're running an attack ad, the odds of someone sort of losing their mind and suing you and filing complaints, doing everything they can to figure out who's behind that ad goes up, I mean, exponentially. Positive ads are safe, negative ads are not. Sort of from a blowback perspective. And so the odds of you getting sued, the odds of there being a governmental investigation against you, like the John Doe sort of fiasco in Wisconsin, or an IRS leak of your documents, the odds of you really maintaining privacy are, you know, sort of very case dependent, and it's uncertain. So the paradigm between like mandatory automatic disclosure and privacy is no longer perceived, at least by sophisticated donors, people who could give six figures or more. They understand that it's mandatory automatic disclosure and like maybe we'll maintain privacy, maybe we won't. A third point is I think that large donors are increasingly comfortable with blowback and getting canceled. All their friends have been canceled. They've probably been canceled. It's like no big deal anymore. I don't mean to say that donor, I say that sincerely. It's not as a joke. I don't mean to suggest that donor privacy or donor disclosures don't chill speech. I promise you they do. I mean, we have, you know, maybe 10 projects in election cycle that die because of donor disclosures. Absolutely chill speech. Whether it's constitutional is kind of a more complicated question, but it does, in fact, chill speech. So, you know, this fight still really matters for a lot of people. There's litigation pending about Governor Goddard's measure. Who knows how that comes out? And for those people, apparently it matters very much. But the you know, just people have learned to kind of adjust their lives on the donor side around this issue and plan accordingly, much more than they could 10 years ago. A couple of other thoughts on ranked choice voting, just because I can't help myself with a microphone in front of me. I guess I'd say two things. If we were to run in your own mind a thought experiment and remove from Congress the fringes, which is often what the ranked choice voting folks say, you know, this is going to result in more moderates, more consensus candidates getting elected. So remove from Congress the Freedom Caucus. So Raul, like, you never would have made it to Congress under this paradigm. And also get rid of the squad, right? AOC and Ilhan Omar. Bernie Sanders has gone to the Senate. Rand Paul. And ask yourself, okay, this is the new Congress. Fast forward 20 years, are taxes higher or lower? Is healthcare more or less centralized? And I think that in my mind, what this will result in is more compromises moving policies to the left. I don't think we're gonna say, well, we won the last one, so now we'll cut taxes this time. The compromises, you know, the political right is more effective at resisting policy drift than the political left is enforcing it. And so if we adopt a system like this over time, I would expect us to move leftward. Second thing I'd say about ranked choice voting is, you know, retirees love voting. Right? They vote really high frequency. In fact, in Arizona, we have a whole system, they call them special election boards. There's one Democrat, one Republican, it has to be that way. They will go to retirement homes and convene everyone. It's kind of a big day, everyone looks forward to it. Right? They're eagerly waiting. The special election boards come in and they personally take the votes from people who can't go to the polls. Some of them also like going to the polls personally. And very high, you know, voter turnout among the retiree population. Would you like to be the one with the assignment of going to the nursing home, being given a whiteboard and explaining ranked choice voting? Like, there are 15 people and you get to say, do you prefer the, you know, 13th one or the 14th one? It is so complicated that I think that what Scott said earlier was that something like 98% of the ballots in Alaska counted. Yes, they counted, but I'm not confident they counted the way that the voters would have intended them to count. And I say this not hyperbolically. If I was forced to explain it to my mother, like, that would not be easy. And I know she would be dissatisfied. The polling on this from Maine, where they've also adopted a ranked choice voting system, shows that voters there are very dissatisfied. They don't understand it entirely. They don't trust it will be implemented entirely. And in this electoral environment, it is better to have rules they're simple, people trust them, a word about simplicity. Remember in Iraq, when they were starting to vote there, they would dip their finger in that purple ink. It's just a very simple system to show that everyone, you can't vote twice if you've got purple ink on your finger. We have much more complicated rules here, controlling who votes where and when and making sure they don't vote twice. And the number of hours I have to spend every November explaining to my clients why you can be sure that double voting didn't affect the outcome of their election. I mean, as rules get more complicated, the distrust goes up again exponentially. And so I would recommend, in looking at things like ranked choice voting, some circumspection, some reticence to change rules that are simple and have worked for two centuries. Like, let's just be careful about that. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for those wonderful opening remarks. Before we get to questions from the audience, I want to give all our panelists an opportunity to respond to anything they've heard. Daniel, I've seen you scribble a lot of notes. I'm sure you have a lot to say. Go for it.
Well, I saw you scribble a note that you were going to ask Daniel what's next.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
I'll answer that question. So let me start by telling you what's not next. What's not next is HR 1. So for those of you who live in this world, House Resolution 1 last Congress was going to be a comprehensive overhaul of campaign finance and election administration done by Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats. And for those of us on the conservative public interest side, it was pretty much of a nightmare. Thankfully, Senate Majority Leader Manchin never scheduled it, and so it never passed. And now Speaker McCarthy's not going to put it on the table. I think the other thing that's not next, and this is perhaps more troubling, is I don't know that we've gotten any closer to solving some of the fundamental trust gaps between a large portion of the American people and election administrators around the results, which is simply to say, like, I think a lot of the people who are unhappy and frustrated about how our last presidential election went have not seen steps taken that give them confidence next time around. And a lot of that, I think, is because they live in red states, and the elections they don't trust are happening in blue states, and the blue state people are not adopting the trust-building measures that they feel like. In other words, if I'm a red state voter living in Georgia, and I look at what's happening in Detroit or Philadelphia and say, I don't think, you know, I'm convinced that they're opening boxes in the back and the unions are filling them out, right? If that's my worldview, like, Pennsylvania and Michigan in blue states are not adopting laws that are going to address that. They're not putting in place photo ID, for instance, right? And so the sad thing that I think is not happening is we're not going to be any closer next time around to having confidence in our elections. The third and final thing I'll say in answering what's next, I don't think any of us know what's next exactly at the Supreme Court, because Justices Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and Barrett haven't really told us either their interest in these issues or how they approach these issues. So in a room full of Federal Society people, you know that obviously Justices Thomas and Scalia saw the world the same 99% of the time. The 1% of the time where Scalia and Thomas consistently disagreed was on these public disclosure issues in electoral contexts. That as an originalist, Justice Thomas looked at this and said, the Federalist Papers were written by Publius. So like, obviously you can do things anonymously. Justice Scalia looked at the historical record and said, you had to show up and tell people who you were voting for out loud in public. We didn't adopt the Australian ballot until the late 1800s. Like, clearly, you know, you got to take a stand for what you believe in America. And so we really just don't know how Justices Kavanaugh or Gorsuch or Barrett will think about these things. They haven't had a vehicle to do it, and perhaps we don't even know, are they interested in it? The corollary question is whether or not Justice Alito has moved at all in how he thinks about these things as cancel culture has unfolded. That you look at him joining the Citizens United and some of these other campaign finance cases, and he seemed kind of on board. But subsequently, he's had some concurring or side opinions where he started to express more and more concern about the way that cancel culture is impacting people. And I think really the question is going to be for him and perhaps several of his colleagues, is the solution to be more generous with as-applied relief? That when organizations or individuals have a reason to think that they are going to be subject to cancel culture, that they're entitled to as-applied relief and that we should be gracious in granting that, because the standard right now is basically you have to have bullets shot at your office in order to qualify for it, the Socialist Committee of 76 case. Or are we going to get facial relief, right? Or is he just going to say, you know what, this has gone too far, and I don't trust lower courts, no offense, to be generous in granting it like I want, and so we're just going to have to go for a broader rule. So what's next? We will see as these cert petitions get up to find out what their appetite is and how they're going to think about it.
Thank you, Daniel. Scott, anything do you want to respond to?
Yeah, a couple quick things, but I did want to say kind of at the outset, appreciate the panel and this audience. I'm learning a lot just kind of sitting here. On the RCV thing and senior citizens, the interesting thing actually we found in our polling was the senior citizens that as a demographic actually got it the best and liked it the most, even though when it was enacted by ballot measure, they were kind of a resistant demographic. I don't know if it's all the omega-3s we're getting from eating all that salmon, but our seniors seem to be right on top of it. But I will say there are ways ranked choice, I don't want to be cavalier about ranked choice voting. I studied it in depth, and there are ways that it breaks down. You have some of these regimes in the Bay Area in New York where when you have 35 candidates, the ballot exhaustion is so dramatic, you drop off and people get elected by 30% of the vote. That's not an optimal way. So that's why we have the filtering process down to four candidates. But honestly, in Alaska, we've got more concerns about, you know, we've got a mail system that takes a literal month to get some of our ballots. You know, we've got ballots that are across the, you know, they're across the date line. They're over next to Russia. Sarah Palin was right. You really can see Russia from parts of Alaska. So we've got those concerns. We're running elections for an entire subcontinent. And we've got, unlike most places, we've got one structure. The state runs it. There's one director of elections, one set of workers. So those are the kind of our concerns. Briefly on disclosure, I sort of align with the Scalia world, which is all of Citizens United, all of that is based on disclosure. It can't be corrupting because we know your name. And I do think that's sort of inherent to sort of the opening up of campaign finance. And I worry that if you start allowing ways to conceal donors, you're going to have a pendulum effect that's going to actually truncate that speech. Now, again, in Alaska, as I think in Arizona, it's very limited. The speech is defined as speech that can only be interpreted as an exhortation to vote for or against someone. So we're not talking about other activities. We're not talking about legislation. We have what's called protected issue speech. You can say X, Y, and Z about an issue and, hey, go ask the governor about it. You can say those things and that's protected speech. It really is that vote for or against someone that triggers everything. But, you know, these kind of disclosures may not be for everywhere. We're a small population state. For $5 million, you could essentially finance every state-level campaign in our state. Not our federal races, of course, you know, because when Senator Murkowski runs, you know, that's one of 100, so it's important to outside interests, but our legislative races, we really do have those fears. And in the early 2000s, we had what was called the VECO scandal, where an oil field service provider was bribing our legislature. 15% of our entire legislature was indicted. Like, those wounds are kind of raw to us. So we are very aware. I do think the solution of the political activities accounts, I think, gets at it, because I do think there is a, I don't want to be so cavalier as to say, let everyone know your name. If you want to donate to the NRA or Planned Parenthood or whatever at organization, you shouldn't have to have your name public unless it's a political activity. But I will say, it's one of the issues that there's rare bipartisan agreement. Everywhere, at least in Alaska, 75 to 80% of all Alaskans want disclosure. And the numbers, believe it or not, are higher with Republicans and conservatives than they are with Democrats. It might be because we see a lot of outside spending. We see a lot of NGOs trying to lock up our lands. But it's what the voters want, which isn't to say you can violate people's rights, but there is a tension there. And I guess I'll just close by saying, you know, maybe none of this matters, because in the era of George Santos, you can apparently make up donors anyway. So maybe none of the disclosures matter at all. But I'll pass it on.
Ouch. Professor?
I'd like to say a little bit more about the Alaska Top 4 system and ranked choice voting. It's also noteworthy that voters in Nevada just endorsed essentially the same structure. It's a top 5 primary with ranked choice voting in the general election. That was on the ballot this cycle in Nevada. It has to be approved in a second vote in the next election before it actually takes effect. And the motivation behind these developments, which I don't think has been kind of adequately put forward so far, is that we have come to understand that the traditional primary election structure is one of the major forces driving extremism in both parties. Members of Congress are mostly in safe seats. They're not going to be defeated in the general election. The fear of being primaried plays a dominant role in the re-election calculus. And the primary electorates are not representative of the general election. They're not even representative of the party for whom that primary is being held. And we have a very real problem with extremism in our political culture, at least I believe we do, which also is connected to the inability of legislatures, particularly Congress, to function effectively for the most part. There are many issues on which people, you know, believe there's an urgency for policy to address that Congress has simply over time become more and more unable to address. And the idea behind the top four primary structure or the top five primary structure is that we don't want candidates who have the broadest appeal to the general electorate, who a majority of the electorate really would like to choose to represent them. We don't want them being filtered out through the structure we have of the traditional primary process, which also makes it possible for more factional kinds of candidates to go into office. So you may be able to win a primary with 35% support. You get voters in the general election have two candidates who are sort of factional candidates from either party. And neither candidate really reflects what a majority of that electorate would prefer. So the motivation here is not so much to elect moderates or not, it's to create a structure in which people who actually have majority support are able to win elections. And I think that's a pretty basic democratic principle that we ought to be striving for. And I think what we've come to see with the distortions our primary election process generates is that we are getting a more and more alienated public, more and more frustrated with Congress's inability to deliver on issues. And that's the deep motivation, as I understand it, for what's been happening both with the development of ranked choice voting and top four and top five primary structures. And I, you know, I just disagree with Corey about what the evidence shows so far with public acceptance of ranked choice voting. If Maine voters don't like it, they can get rid of it. But in fact, what you see happening is more and more adoptions throughout the country in Utah. And this is in red states, blue states, purple states. In Utah, 23 cities, including Salt Lake, are now going to be using ranked choice voting. We see voters in Nevada opting for this, Maine, But I want you to understand what the driving motivation is behind this political reform effort around changing the structure of the primary election process so voters in the general election can really elect people that a majority of them want to represent them.
Thank you. Professor Smith?
I would love to talk about it, ranked choice voting election stuff, but I'm going to stay focused on the narrow topic of disclosure here and make a few quick points. First, we don't really get to talk about the burdens of the Arizona law, for example, and this is intended to be a prototype to be used throughout the country. And under the Arizona law, you have to track things back. So if you give $2,500 to your church over the course of a year, and your church gives money to a nonprofit, and the nonprofit gives money to another nonprofit, and that nonprofit spends $25,000 on a political campaign, your name will be reported as a donor for that political activity. Moreover, note that everybody's got to keep those records, and you have to keep them for a period of time, and the Clean Elections Commission, as it's called, can walk in anytime they want and inspect it. And we could go on, but you shouldn't underestimate those burdens. Similarly, those apply to things like political accounts. Those are handy if you're a great big organization. They're not handy if you're a little organization that's planning to spend, you know, $50,000 or $60,000, which even in Alaska is not a ton of money for an organization to spend, and especially for other organizations. Plus, these political activity accounts are intended by the left, and they're pretty open about this, to peel off people. It's the name and shame. So now you have to say, when you give money to a group, whether you're going to let them spend it on, quote, political purposes or not, well, now they can put pressure on you. You shouldn't let them do that. And they'll tell you to some ad they don't like. That ad was a nasty ad. Or, did you fund that ad? Why didn't you check no? And the idea is to peel it off. Of course, the whole reason people often join trade associations and so on is precisely for the protection of the herd, right? They want protection in numbers. They don't want to be singled out. And the idea is to peel them off and make sure that they can't do that. We should also not limit this as saying, well, this is just for political communications. Well, sure. But Arizona defines political communications, like I say, as anything that promotes, attacks, supports, or opposes a candidate 6 months before an election. They define political communications as anything that mentions a candidate within 90 days before an election of the primary, all the way through to the general election. So in other words, they're not talking political activity as it was blessed by the Supreme Court in Buckley, which is these contributions specifically to individuals. And what this does is this is going to let the sort of exceptions swallow the whole, the idea that you have a right to be free of this. Because as soon as you start disclosing this, the people who do care about disclosure, as Corey says, some don't, but the people who do are going to find the next way out that they can stay private, right? Or they'll drop out of the political system. If they find the next way out that they can stay private, then these reformers will come up here and they'll say, well, the new problem now is, and we need regulation to govern it. And this is what the court, I think, in Bonta kind of said, no, you can't keep doing that. You can't keep letting this little core of stuff you want disclosed keep spreading out to swallow up the First Amendment and people's right to anonymity. So I think those kinds of things are very important to remember. As far as public opinion, I'm not much moved by it. If you take a public opinion poll, do you favor clean elections? Yeah, everybody favors clean elections. Anybody here want to oppose clean elections? Okay, there you go. We got 100% in the Federalist Society, no yet less, favor clean elections. But when you actually start asking people the details, the polling numbers drop dramatically. Well, should your contributions be disclosed? Whoosh, public support plummets. Should your employer's name be disclosed on that? Whoosh, public support plummets again. And you see that repeatedly. These things go on the ballot with the name clean elections, you know, stop dark money, and it's all essentially kind of a propaganda effort. That doesn't mean that the passage of these things is illegitimate just because people, you know, you take the Arizona Commission, right? The voters had information. They knew who they were voting for. They had candidates go out to vote, right? We may not like it, just like I don't like these misleading referenda on dark money or clean elections, but we recognize that the voters get that. That's how politics is played. You try to put your political views into the most palatable package and get them passed, but I don't think the fact that somebody has succeeded at that should make us think that therefore, you know, this is all fine and dandy and we should go forward with it into the indefinite future. So Those are just a few thoughts on sort of thinking about the disclosure issue. I guess I would leave us with this idea here. You know, Scalia would say people need to be bold, you know, like Abraham Lincoln and Jefferson and Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, all of whom did anonymous speech, Thomas Paine. They weren't bold. But you know, okay, Scalia wants us all to be bold, and I have great admiration for Justice Scalia, who did have lifetime tenure in his job without a salary reduction, full-time security detail, and had a very outgoing personality. He loved to go at it with people. But a lot of people don't. A lot of people are more shy, more reticent. They don't want their name in the paper. And we need to think, does the First Amendment protect the meek? Do these people have ideas that maybe we should hear? Right? Are people who are more afraid of cancel culture entitled to that protection as well? And would we as a society benefit from hearing their voices? Maybe those are exactly the voices we ought to be hearing. So I would urge us all to keep that in mind. It's not just that we have nefarious dark money people running nasty ads. It may be that we have some of our better ideas, our moderating ideas, our people who are least aggressive in the political arena who are being shut out.
General, any remarks?
Well, I never thought I heard satiric remarks about Justice Scalia in this context, but there you go. I'd like to thank Corey for basically pointing out the ideological shift that's taken place. I can tell you I've been at this for quite a few years in trying to see disclosure as a very positive good for voters in Arizona. And I can tell you that the support and the knowledgeable support has been bipartisan. It's been very conservative and very liberal. And most recently, as Corey pointed out, it's been the left that has dominated the dark money scenario. It's been the Soroses and others. And we've just seen in Arizona, in the last election, we vote on retention of judges in the three most populous counties. And in the last election, a very liberal group anonymously attacked three of our Supreme Court justices who were up for election. So this is certainly not an ideological or, I think, political. I encourage the Federalist Society and all on the right to say, don't we profit, all of us, from knowing who's speaking as well as what they're saying? I mean, we can't, if you're in a trial, obviously you have the opportunity to voir dire, you have the opportunity to interrogate the expert witnesses and find out what their biases may be. Voters need to have the same ability, and that's what Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy in Citizens United said very clearly and very, very strongly. And our experience, 72% was how many Arizona voters voted in favor, and this wasn't an exercise in buzzwords. I would have loved it to be so, because I've polled anti-dark money issues, and it's in the 90%. But what was on the ballot, here's what Arizona voters voted on. Listen for the key buzzwords. Amending Title 16, Arizona Revised Statutes, by adding Chapter 6.1 relating to the disclosure of the original source of monies used for campaign media spending. There are no buzzwords there, and in fact, I think it dropped 10 points off of our total, because it's very hard to understand right away what that particular description says. One quick statement, and I probably that shouldn't introduce a whole new one, but in Arizona, we've been at the sort of the front line of the whole question about election integrity. And I want to give a shout out, this may surprise a few of you, to the Republican Party in Arizona, who has dominated our politics since reapportionment in 1964. And they have devised an election system which, as being the Attorney General for 8 years, I was had the privilege of enforcing and doing some investigations as to election results. And it's a really good one. I think we should be terribly proud in our state of having done motor voter first and then vote by mail, which 90% of our electorate uses. It was all done by Republican legislators and signed by Republican governors. And yet it's been some Republican candidates who have said that this is a highly suspect system. This is one that should not bear scrutiny. And frankly, they're just blowing smoke. And I had the opportunity with one county election to go in because there was a lot of very credible criticism. And we did a complete hand recount of not Maricopa County, but Pima, the next largest county in Arizona. And the result came, in spite of some very legitimate concerns, within 4 votes of the original machine total. So I thought we did a pretty good job. I think our election officials did a pretty good job. And I, for one, think that the constant baiting of the election system by some candidates is just because they don't like the result, doesn't mean the system's at fault. So take a look at Arizona. I think you'll be very pleased at what you see. Thanks.
General? Corey, any remarks?
I agree with what General Goddard said at the end. The margin of victory in Arizona elections, and I think this is true in the other states that I've worked as well, but since we're talking about Arizona, the margin of victory is almost always, I mean, like less than 1% of elections, would the margin of victory be smaller than the potential margin for error and fraud given the procedures that are in place? And almost every state has sufficient redundancies in place that, like, I regard our elections as very reliable. On ranked choice voting, one final thought. I think we're approaching the end here. If we're going to be making a fundamental shift in the way that we pick our leaders, we should have a very a broad and thoughtful conversation about what that looks like. And one of my procedural objections with the way this is unrolled in the various states is that traditionally there's a large money group from out of state that drops a ballot measure that they've drafted. They've not negotiated with all the local stakeholders and said, like, this is it, go. Like, are you a yes or are you a no? And, you know, there's so many questions that are tied up in that. For example, why are we doing ranked choice voting instead of approval voting? Like, I am genuinely bewildered at why we can't have a conversation about this, because approval voting is like, vote for everyone that you approve of. And in 2016, for many voters in the primaries, it would have been anyone except Donald Trump. A lot of Republican voters had that view, and because we had a first-past-the-post system, they didn't matter, right? And it's so simple, right? Like, we're accustomed to binary decisions in voting where you are voting yes or no fundamentally. Ranked choice, where it's not binary, it's, you know, like, put in numerical order that you're 35 preferred candidates in San Francisco. This is insane. Why can't we have this discussion before the out-of-state group drops their ballot measure and says yes or no? Because when they do that, there's a real, you can look around the country, if you're paying attention, you can look around and say, it's not going that well right now. Like, I think there's a broad consensus, like, something should change. And if they just drop this on us without a discussion, say, like, are you a yes or are you a no? A lot of people will say yes just because it's something else, but it could be much better if we were to have this sort of conversation before they roll out. Thanks.
Thank you. So now we'll take some questions from the audience. I think there'll be microphones walking around. When you ask your question, please state your name and where you're from. We have a question over here.
Paul Krause, and I'm from Oakland, California. And my question is for Professor Pildes, and I'm going to pick up a little bit on what Mr. Langhofer has said. We'll call it the palatable candidate problem. Why does a jungle primary not solve that problem? Why is ranked choice voting in addition to a jungle primary needed to solve that problem?
Well, if you have a top four primary, a jungle primary, if you want to use that language, you have four people going into the general election. It's entirely possible, if you use just a traditional voting system, that you're going to get a factional candidate who may have 28-29% of the vote who gets elected.
Where you have a Georgia system where you have a runoff.
Yeah, so
why do you need ranked choice voting?
That's a very good question. I view runoff elections and ranked choice voting as substitutes for each other to an extent. They're both trying to do the same thing. And in fact, if you look at presidential elections in other countries, overwhelmingly they have a two-round process with a runoff election, as France most notably, you know, does. The problem with the runoff election option in the United States has been, number one, turnout drops dramatically for that runoff. Now, that hasn't been true in these last two Georgia Senate runoffs because they've been super high-profile elections with major policy, partisan national implications. But turnout in runoff elections is very, very much below the general election. So you're not getting a representative electorate. It's also, you know, very costly for election for states to run a second election, and it puts a big burden on the election administrators. But the main thing is you're not getting the same representative electorate you get in the general election.
Scott, did you want to add anything on that?
Yeah, I think you raise an excellent point. And I think, you know, even though I helped design the ballot measure, I don't necessarily think Alaska's system would be best for every state. We're states, like I said, 62, 63% don't affiliate with either party. We looked at how a top two would shake out, and we actually thought, we're going to get some aberrant outcomes. We're going to get some weird stuff here where the top two, you know, we've got the Alaska Independence Party. We've got a lot of political diversity. But I think it's the whole laboratories of democracy thing. Like, take a look at it. We're trying it out. Study us. See.
But doesn't that kind of manipulation of outcome by changing the process, isn't that what is creating the distrust? When you say, well, in Alaska, we have this system, and we would still get some aberrant results in a runoff. Isn't that kind of planning, if you will, precisely the kind of overstep that's creating distrust?
I mean, I don't believe so. I mean, in our state, and I won't speak for other states, we have, you know, not just politically, geographically. We have the poorest census districts in the country. We have some of the wealthiest. We're incredibly diverse. So truncating choices, I mean, it's like I said, it's free market elections. If you have more choices on that ballot, you have more voters engaged. We've got interesting things happening. We've got a 20-person Senate. We have one of the smallest cameral bodies in the country. We have a 17-person majority that's bipartisan. They formed up 3 days after certification of the election. They formed a 17 out of 20-person majority. Top two wouldn't work the same in Alaska as it might work in your state, but I will say this, you know, ranked choice voting is if it's handled right and it's not the 35-candidate, you know, ballot of death, it's not that complicated. You know, you go, I mean, and I don't mean to make it, I don't mean to be frivolous, but you go into Baskin-Robbins, they're out of chocolate, you choose vanilla, you don't choose dirt flavored ice cream. You don't get, in first past the post, you truly do get exactly what you want, or you get the opposite. And it's not that exotic in the sense that Ireland and Australia have been doing it for over a century. I don't think they're smarter than us. I don't think they're more politically sophisticated than we are.
Any other questions? Go here, right over here.
Thank you. I'm not even into the 20th century with technology. I'm the director of the UCLA Center for the Liberal Arts and Free Institutions and an emeritus law professor at UCLA. In 1972, I was working for the Secretary of State of California, who was named Jerry Brown. And the disclosure system that we had then was based on a very old law, and it was essentially entirely worthless. The forms that were used for the disclosure statements were not put out by the state or any governmental body. They were prepared by the vendors who sold paper for ballots to the counties as a public relations service, and they were designed to make it impossible to glean any useful information from them. So one of the things that I did in the Secretary of State's office was to revise these forms. The Secretary of State was going to prescribe forms, and they were going to be set up so that you could at least get some information from them. When we designed this form and had already started printing them and sent them up to the legislature, I was summoned up to the speaker's office and had this whole circumstance were amusing. I won't go into that, but I had a colloquy with Willie Brown, who was then a member of the leadership in the legislature. And Willie said that this is going to be a disaster for the Democratic Party. And I said, how so? And he said, well, Everybody knows, or everybody assumes, that Republicans are getting their money, or a lot of their money, from racetracks and from cigarette companies and from oil companies and so on. Now they're going to find out that we get our money from the same places. And I did not think that was a convincing argument to me as to why we should go back to utterly worthless disclosure. For most of my life, for most of my career, I've supported campaign disclosure. And as Brad Smith said, most people have. I think Brad had some skepticism about it when he began writing on this subject, although I don't think you ever came out actually against it, and I don't think you did today. But what I want to mention is that circumstances have changed. I think at least in this state, they changed with Proposition 208, which was intended to reaffirm the idea that marriage is a union between a man and a woman. And there was a very substantial attack on people who contributed to the campaign for Proposition 208. I myself received two very crude and very disgusting letters, which didn't bother me that much, although I negligently left them around. My wife saw one of these and she got very upset by it. But I had a student who's...
Sir, do you have a question you want to ask?
Yeah. Okay. The question is this. The changes in mores have been tremendous in the last 10 or 20 years. Somebody used the phrase cancel culture. We're all familiar with that. I think this really changes the way one has to think about disclosure. The question is, obviously as a political matter, we can do that, but should that affect constitutional doctrine? Should the meaning of the Constitution change when mores in the society significantly change the effects of
Thank
how something's
you, sir.
Done?
Anyone want to respond to that?
Let me throw in one fairly important nuance here. At least in Arizona, and I think it's true across the country, everyone who gives to a political candidate is disclosed. I mean, I haven't heard any discussion about that. We're talking about the fraction of 1% that use intermediaries, dark money intermediaries, to hide their identity. So we're not talking about cancel culture for the 99%, are we? They apparently... Oh, so you want to get rid of all disclosure. Okay, well, let's be clear. Because if you think nobody should be disclosed, that ought to be taken out into the open. But right now, there is general acceptance that if you contribute to a political campaign, your name, your address, in Arizona, it's your home address, and your employer are part of the disclosure. And all we're asking for in Prop 211, which I was working on, is that would also apply to those who try to disguise their contributions through an intermediary.
So I think we have time for one more question before lunch, and just realize you are keeping people from eating, so keep it short. hold on 1 second, microphone's right there.
Byron Hayes from Los Angeles, just pointing out that California has changed in the way that they do their ballots now, and they mail a ballot to every registered voter, and you can mail it back in or you can go to a receptacle area to drop it off. And I'm wondering how that plays into the, I'm wondering if that's going to be a national trend or not, and how that plays into the disclosure.
Go ahead, Professor Smith.
I just may use this to make a couple quick comments, I hope. I don't know how it plays into the disclosure. I will say, when we talk about trust in elections, it's just kind of been a little sub-issue we haven't really gotten to. One of the few things I've seen, there's one big factor that gives people confidence that the election results are accurate, and that's if their candidate won. The other thing that I've seen that shows it, and I don't think there's enough you know, replicated studies to say this with great confidence, but it's still, it's really the only thing I've shown that shows that it increases public confidence is if people vote in person at the polls. People who do that tend to be more confident that the election is being handled properly. And I think that's partly because they see what's going on, and they see that it's fair, and they see that it's good, and they see that these people aren't corrupt and nefarious and so on. And I do think that we should generally kind of, I don't like mailing ballots to everybody. I think there's something good in standing in line at the polls with your neighbors and realizing they're not the devil incarnate just because they're voting for the wrong guy. I think there's something good about a society saying, this is the day we come out and we come together and govern ourselves, and this isn't like voting for the stars or, you know, American Idol or Dancing with the Stars or something. I think there's, it's also, up until 3 years ago, 2 years ago, really, you could have walked in 3 years ago, I guess, any political science conference in the country and noted that there's more fraud in absentee balloting than elsewhere. And everybody would have said, yeah, tell me the sun rises in the east. I mean, what, you know, what are you, yeah, so what, right? There's not a lot of fraud. I don't think a lot of fraud by any means, but there is more. And also, absentee ballots mailed in are more likely to be rejected. There's not a lot that are rejected. Most that are counted. You know, I think this idea of massive fraud and that sort of thing is all kind of crazy. But they are more likely to be rejected. So I'll kind of close, since I had the invitation, to make a little pitch that we should be thinking more, and by the way, I appreciate this from all the panelists, because in some ways we've talked about this, is how do we, you know, what do we want from elections? It's not just about the convenience of voters, and there may be very competing views about what voters should know in terms of information and what people we want to participate in and so on, but we need to think more seriously about that before we just start mailing ballots to everybody and saying, yeah, just vote. Let's think about what we want to accomplish with the elections.
So if I can add a quick footnote on that, it's not just fraud when it comes to mail-in ballots in the sense of like people who are stealing somebody else's ballot. It's also people who wouldn't vote but who then choose to vote because they are pressured into voting, right? So a vote that is cast after what some people would call ballot harvesting, right? If there's a union organizer who comes to your door and says, hey, have you voted yet in a mail-in ballot state? Like, that person's a legitimate voter, they cast a legitimate vote. It's not a fraudulent vote, but that person may not have taken the time and effort to go vote in person on election day. It was only because somebody came knowing who they were, knowing what their politics were, knowing that they were a member of their union or that they were in this particular demographic group or they live in this particular apartment building that encouraged them to vote. And so I think it's important when we think about mail-in balloting, it's not just actual fraud in terms of people who are casting illegal ballots. It's also the way that we change when people choose to vote and how they choose to participate and what that ends up doing for balance within our system.
Great. Well, that will have to be the last word. Thank you, everyone, for a wonderful panel.